Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Acceptable Accuracy Podcast. I'm Philip.
And I'm Tyler.
And today we are going to talk about what's the topic for today, Tyler?
Today we're going to dig deep into long-range shooting, which I know absolutely nothing about.
So we're going to dig deep, but this is going to be an introduction to long-range shooting. Sure. And I want to jump right into introducing our guests, because I feel like whenever we don't, we end up talking with them for like 5 minutes and then we introduce them. So anyway, Tyler, would you like to introduce our guests today?
Sure.
You introduce one, I'll introduce the other. How about that?
Sure. I'm going to go ahead and introduce Levi, even though I just met him 5 minutes ago. So what's up, Levi?
Yeah, not a whole lot. Hopefully I can add something to this.
You'll add a lot more than I ever could.
Absolutely. And then I will, I'll introduce Daryl. So Daryl, you want to say hi real quick?
I would love to say hi and thank you for having me back. And I will definitely add something to this. I just don't know how good it'll be.
Oh, you'll do great, Daryl. We're looking forward to having Daryl as well, because for those who don't know, Daryl is on our Wolverine 5K squad and he is our long distance guy. So he's better than the three of us, that's for sure.
I know. I love the confidence in our guests today. It's fantastic. We talked about this prior to the recording of today's podcast. Something we like to call in the industry imposter syndrome, where people get really good at something and then they are like, "No, I'm not that great at it." But truth be told, they've done a fantastic job. So as we kind of get into this, I just want to, before we dive into the podcast, let's just take a moment and appreciate the fact that we all somehow managed to adult our way here today. Tyler,
are you including me in that group?
I am. I'm including all of us in that group.
Yeah, Levi's sure like, I've bro, I am yet. An adult. What you talking about, bro? Ah, I tried. I got you, man.
I was thinking like the other day. It was Elon Musk, I think it is, who says that we are all living in like a simulation. Like he thinks that there's a good chance that we're living in a simulation. So then I always wonder, like, are we living in a simulation, and is that simulation like actually like a video game, and are we the NPCs, or are we like the main player character, like the James Bond, or the I'm trying to think of another main, like the Master Chief of our own existence. I have no idea. That no comment. Yeah, apparently I'm the only one that plays video games here. So
yeah.
Oh my god, it's been a while.
All right, well, let's dive right into it. Since my simulation comment completely fell flat to everybody,
literally. But yeah, so let's go ahead and talk about our guest today. So Levi, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself? Who are
and
you?
I guess
what got you into long range shooting?
Yep, and to quantify that, what kind of like, and I know you guys joked about this earlier, but what qualifies you to chat today about long range shooting with us? Like, what do you do?
Well, so I guess my journey started is my dad took me on a hunting trip to, I grew up hunting, shooting, all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
Basically 100 yards, everything hunting scenario in Michigan, which is you're lucky to get anything over 100 yards. Then my dad, I kind of fell out of hunting as I got into motorsports stuff, raced ATVs professionally for a while. So that was a lot of fun and kind of took up, when you're 18 to 25, being on ESPN is a little bit cooler than hunting with your dad. And as we aged out, he wanted to, go hunting with his two sons. So he basically bought my brother and I a hunt to New Mexico. And that was kind of the first time I left the state to go hunting and realized that I kind of enjoyed the how am I going to make this shot at any kind of distance. So I took my first mule deer out there at just over 300 yards and kind of fell in love with it. So then it was, come back home and figure out how I was going to get a longer range built here. And as you stretch out a little bit, you start looking at the different firearms, how to build them, how to shoot them, and then just year after year, try to find somebody that's significantly better than me and pick their brain, you know, pick up a little bit here and there. And, you know, next thing you know, you feel much more comfortable. Obviously there's always that little bit of doubt. And, you know, if you don't have that, I think you're doing it wrong. But, you know, next thing you know, then cold bore 1,000-yard shots are fairly easy.
Nice.
You know, as far as they could go. And then, you know, it kind of translates into hunting. So obviously you tone everything back because there's a little bit more involved there. And, you know, everything's not perfect off of a bench or laying prone. And, yeah, and then that led into obviously reloading and stuff like that. So.
So I feel there is a lot to unpack right there.
Yeah, I was going to say, including
I definitely want to talk to Daryl as well. But there are two things that really stuck out to me right there, Levi. One, did you just say, yes, professional ATV, but you are on ESPN?
Yeah, so I found I didn't really start riding until I was about 18 years old. And I found out I had a knack for it. I bought a snowmobile and went riding with the right person who – that same winter came over, talked to my parents, and gave me pretty much a ride on a satellite snowmobile snowcross team. They had a position for a beginner, and I ended up doing very well there. And then I just tried to stay in shape and, you know, keep up with that demand. I bought an ATV that year, and that's kind of where my talent was. I didn't really have to practice at that. And about my third year in, I was able to go pro, and at that time ESPN kind of came in and merged. So yeah, I got to be on ESPN a few times.
So what you're telling me is we have two TV stars on here right now.
Well, maybe. No, I wouldn't call a star. I mean, I made some appearances, and I didn't get severely hurt on any of those, so I guess that was a victory.
For sure. That's awesome. Well, cool. Well, Daryl, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and what qualifies you to be a long range shooter? What got you started into it? Tell us about that.
Well, for starters, the long range moniker is not really fitting to me. I consider myself more mid range.
Okay. What do you mean by
that? Well, so if you're looking at it from a hunting standpoint, a 1,000-yard shot is considered long range. If you're looking at it from a target standpoint, which is more what I do,
okay,
long range doesn't really come into play until 1,500 to 2,000 yards, which I have never gone out to.
So, how far out have you gone into?
1,000. I can do 1,000 yards.
Which to me is insane. Like, I can't even imagine that.
It's farther than a lot of people go, but, you know, we're talking within this group, if there was other long range shooters around, they would probably agree with me that that is not a long range shot anymore. It used to be, but
I would have to agree.
Interesting.
So,
and I know that PRS, like, I think typically they shoot out to 1,000 yards, but I guess it's more PRS being Precision Rifle Series. And I guess they wouldn't necessarily call themselves long range shooters anymore then either.
Well, I guess they might. It depends on what state they're in. If you're in Michigan, they probably would. If you're out in Wyoming, probably not.
That is fair. That's valid. That makes sense.
Yeah, and do you think that's primarily because of the technology and the quality of rifles available today and the quality of the ammunition that makes it?
Yep. Definitely.
That is something similar to what Tyler said. I definitely want to unpack that, and we'll definitely do that later in the podcast as well to talk about the gear and equipment to get us there. But it's really interesting.
That is. So to kind of backtrack a little, so Daryl, what got you into, I guess, mid-range shooting, as you'd like to more describe yourself as?
I didn't really grow up hunting. And what I did do in my younger years was more upland bird hunting. A few years ago, maybe 15, 12 years ago, I was working with a fella who had a farm that he deer hunted on. And part of what he did to repay the farmer for being able to hunt on this property was take care of his woodchuck problem. So I started going out there with him and hunting woodchucks, and that was, you know, we were reaching out 500-600 yards on a woodchuck, which is a pretty good shot.
Yeah, no
and
kidding.
That's where I started looking into how to make myself a little bit more accurate at those distances. Took a class on reloading, which just did amazing things for me. And put together my first real long range, or mid range, excuse me, rifle, the one that we use for the Wolverine 5K. I modeled after the Marine, what is it, the M40 A5 series.
Okay.
So interesting. It's a Remington 700 bolt action. I bedded it to the stock myself, mounted the scope on it. I fashioned it as close as I could to that M40 design because I really liked it. And I do have to say that about the same time I was starting this was when the movie American Sniper came out. And that didn't That's hurt awesome. Anything.
All right, Chris Kyle.
Do you put your hat backwards too when you're doing this?
I do. If I have
my man.
Yep. Because otherwise it hits the scope and that's not good.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I definitely.
Yeah,
that's
how I
times.
Got started with it, and just kind of learned a lot. I self-taught myself a lot, not self-taught, but had to get on YouTube and educate myself as to what I should listen to and what I shouldn't listen to. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, I guess that brings up a good point about the amount of information out there. That there is a lot of good information on YouTube for anything, right? But then there's always that risk of finding stuff that's really not great information out there. So, and that's honestly one of the reasons why I brought both you and Levi on, was to kind of get like the good information out for people who are beginning in this space. And I like the fact that the both of you have a different background in long range or precision shooting. One of you is definitely in hunting and the other one's more of like, again, a precision shooter level. And yeah, I would say that a lot of the stuff that you do is very similar in the way that you work on loads. The rifles, I'm guessing we're going to find out, are a little bit different. And maybe the type of scope may be similar, but I know there's a lot of different options out there depending on what you're doing in that space, whether it's hunting or whether it's long range. And I will brag for Daryl, because I know he won't, but he carries the steel silhouette shoot record. He tied, apparently, he corrected me on today, at our sportsman's club, which is, and what's the behind silhouette, Daryl? I know a little bit about it. I know that there are small targets at, like, in our case, our range at 500 meters, but if you want to kind of give a description of how precision comes into play.
It's a 500 meter range, and we are shooting at NRA chickens, which are normally shot at 200 yards for the NRA match, but we put them out at 500 meters, and there are a couple of them that are even smaller than that. So it starts, the biggest target is an NRA chicken, and then it goes down. I think there's one that's even half that size, but it's not considered a bench rest match, but we do shoot off of benches for it. So you have 10 targets with 90 seconds and one reload to knock those chickens over.
Now, how big are the chickens?
Awesome. Probably 8 inches tall and maybe 10 inches wide. You know, it's the shape of a chicken, so that it gets smaller as you go down. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, they're square chickens. No, they're not. They're the shape.
Oh, no, there we go.
That's funny. Man. So,
yes, it was my first time out there doing that match, and I got 17 out of 20, which was tied the club record.
That's incredible. I love how you did it on the first try. I'm sure all the other guys that were there, like, just threw their guns in the ditch and gave up after that day.
That's well, great. I hope not.
So one of the questions I got for the both of you, and we'll start with Levi on this one, but what qualifies long range shooting or precision shooting? Like, how would you differentiate that from like a standard, like you know, semi-automatic firearm, and maybe there are some semi-automatic firearms that you could consider long range or precision, but what makes like long range shooting, precision shooting different than like your traditional individual who's at it like a 100-yard bay, for example?
I think it's all, are you asking like the rifle differences or what scenario you'd be in?
Yeah, I guess like the skill sets that are needed, and we'll step into gear here a little bit.
So for me, it's a lot of, it would be more similar to PRS. I think that would be the closest to a hunting, but you have to think that none of your equipment that you brought in most hunting scenarios you'll find yourself in, everything you think you're going to plan for is different. So you'll be, you know, instead of being able to use a bipod, your bipod's usually too short to get over the grass. So then you're stacking a backpack on something. If you're trying to lay prone or you're a lot of uncomfortable positions, rocks in your side, stuff like that. Shooting not in perfect, up and down angles, cold hands, stuff like that. That seems to be the biggest difference for me, is working off of a bench as opposed to, you know, in the field.
Interesting.
So I guess my question for, I guess Daryl already touched upon this, so for you, Levi, is what is your preferred rifle for precision target shooting? What do you like to use?
So if I do most of my shooting still off of cement benches at my range. So I kind of use a myriad of things to save money. Obviously, just a cheap 223. I try to work on more trigger pull, follow through, stuff like that. Not necessarily the accuracy. If I get into trying to keep score, I've got a custom built by Pierce Engineering 6.5 Creedmoor that I really like. It's built as an ultralight, so it's difficult to hunt, which off of a bench is, you know, fairly okay to do, but that's my main hunting rifle. So I tend to lean towards what I'm going to use is what I'll practice with the most leading up to any kind of hunting scenario.
I find this, like, this whole space is extremely fascinating and very unique to me. Like, I've done some, like, quote-unquote precision shooting, but have only begun to really scratch the surface of what it means to do any kind of long-range precision-type shots. But Daryl, I'm also curious on your thoughts of, like, what kind of, what really makes, for you, makes shooting precision different from shooting, again, like a pistol or a carbine, for example?
Well, I guess precision, you know, shooting the carbine or the pistol with the way that we do it, you know, use USPSA and things like that, we're using what we call a defensive accuracy, which means that any round that hits the target is, you know, a good round, scores. Well, if you're trying to do precision off of a bench, that is not the case. Now you're looking for accuracy. You're looking for taking your time and getting all of your impacts in close proximity with each other.
If that so it's makes more sense. Of like Daryl, a
what was that?
I appreciate Daryl. I appreciate that you said defensive accuracy, but I wish you said acceptable accuracy, bro.
Well, I was going to make a joke about that you may shoot defensive accuracy, but Tyler and I shoot acceptable accuracy.
Well, that's my CPL background talking there, fellas. Sorry.
There we go. For those who don't know, Daryl is also a CPL instructor.
Go ahead.
Now, defensive accuracy is putting all of your rounds on target as quickly as you can. And, you know, marksmanship is taking your time and getting them into a very, very small spot.
So, Daryl, I have a question for you. Do you find yourself, because you mentioned that there's obviously, and that's kind of how I look at it, there's two different ways to do. You can go, you know, for precision, and that definitely helps. And then in the hunting scenario, it sounds more like it's the, you know, you're trying to get rounds on target at the end of the day. Do you use one or the other to kind of prepare you for the other end of it? Like, so I do a lot of bench shooting, trying to really work on all of my skills and create that muscle memory so that when I am in the hunting field, obviously there's no, you know, it's not about getting a group. It's that first shot, make everything work. Work on all your skills to know that you're capable of doing it. And then hopefully everything comes in, you know, when I do go to the range and I'm trying to put multiple targets in, you know, in a faster scenario, it seems to help and hurt me a little bit. Do you find that kind of the same thing?
As far as helping, yes. I'm not sure what you're talking about hurting, but yeah, that another reason that we used to do the groundhog thing was just to maintain our fundamentals of, you know, holding on the target and pressing the trigger and getting a good impact so that when it, you know, we were shooting all summer long when deer season rolled around, it wasn't that big of a change for us. It wasn't a change at all.
Okay. What I run into sometimes is I'll spend a ton of time on the bench, longer range before I'm getting ready to go, you know, say to Colorado where I know I'm going to have the opportunity to shoot over 500 yards at animals. And what I find when I get there is if I don't spend any time off of a tripod, you know, prone, just if I don't spend any time other than on the bench, I'll waste a lot of good opportunities waiting for everything to line up perfect. Like, oh, I want my crosshairs to be dead steady. You know, there's a big difference on how stable you can get on a bench as opposed to, you know, anywhere else in a real life scenario. And I find that at some point I'm focusing too much on perfection instead of just getting around on the game that I'm after.
Certainly. Absolutely. Yeah. If you spend all your time on a bench, and that's one of the things we found out last year at the Wolverine 5K, we spent too much time on the benches. And it cost us a little bit, but yes, you do need to, get off the bench and use some, not really unsupported, but not necessarily,
like some uncomfortable type positions.
Yes.
That was the big thing I needed to change. I started off with, you know, just shooting off of a tree or whatever you had. And then when I got into really trying to dial it in for precision shooting, getting back to that was difficult. And now I'm trying to integrate, you know, just shooting off a lightweight tripod and stuff like that before I go out.
Yeah, that is really interesting because I know that, like, PRS, for example, the Precision Rifle Series, like we talked about before, they do a lot of shooting from weird positions as well, too, and trying to get the accuracy. Obviously, under, like, a clock in the Wolverine 5K is like that. And I got to imagine that hunting in the field, you may be moving from point A to point B, and then all of a sudden you see your target, especially at long range, and you're like, crap, well, I guess this is where we're shooting from now. And obviously, there, if you're deer hunting, there's an opportunity to get set up in your stand or whatever it may be to get set up and get that good shot. But you never know where the animal is going to be, and you may be having to twist in that position or whatever in order to get a proper shot at. So do you guys spend time? It sounds like Levi mentioned he spent some time in those positions, but is that something that you, as a new shooter, would do right off the bat? Or is that something that maybe you kind of graduate into over time?
For me, when I take somebody new out, I try to spend more time on the bench just because you have to start with the fundamentals in I call it muscle memory of not jerking the trigger. I'm actually working with a friend right now that realized, you know, shooting off of, you know, his limited hunting he thought was good until you get into those scenarios. So now it's start back over, try to get all the fundamentals, you know, at 100 yards, get him so he's accurate, comfortable, and we'll spend, you know, normally now we'll do, you know, 100 yards, 200, 300. And I kind of stop there until they're, you know, proficient at that range, and we'll do some bench shooting, and then we finish it off with, you know, uncomfortable positions so that he knows, you know, it's kind of a confidence builder too. He knows that he can hit the target, and he knows he can hit where he aims. Now it's just knowing that you're not going to get that perfect, like my crosshairs are going to be in the perfect spot. He knows that you're getting it for, let's call the vitals, or a round on target, basically.
Yeah, that seems like a really great way to get people started off. And it's interesting because I never think of it from a hunting perspective, because I don't dare say this out loud because I'm going to get shamed, but I don't hunt. I've always been more of like the sport side of shooting. And it's not because I'm completely pro hunting, but I just not a huge fan of like deer meat, for example. Though I have asked Levi multiple times to take me out west hunting. At some point we'll have to get that set up. Now that I've got more flexibility with my current role, my current job. But one thing I want to kind of get into here is the gear to get into long range and precision shooting. The most important thing I would say is, like, right off the bat, is the type of rifle. Is that where you start when you're looking at like long range precision shooting? Do you start for the rifle, or do you start elsewhere, or the caliber maybe?
I personally try to get people started on the caliber, with the, you know, the focus of something they can shoot comfortably a lot, because growing up in Michigan, you know, everybody on this podcast is, you know, wanted to be started with a 30-06 or something like that. I found just get them into a very comfortable caliber, you know, 243, 6.5 Creedmoor, and then kind of let them pick out the rifle, and every rifle can be accurate enough to start with.
So let's say someone is...
It depends on the ultimate goal. If you are doing this for a hunt, from a hunting standpoint, you need a cartridge that's going to have some knockdown power at that distance. If you're just putting a hole in paper, it doesn't need to be that big of a round.
That's fair. So let's say someone's completely new and their goal is hunting. What would the top three calibers be that you guys would recommend?
Well, I'm very biased towards the 308.
Okay. That's great.
I was listening to a podcast where I think it was the Vortex Nation podcast, and they're talking about America's cartridge, and I think it came down between 30-06 and 308, which, you know, they're similar. I mean, I'm sure I'll get yelled at for that from listeners, but it's hard to go wrong with a 308.
Yeah,
I know nothing about any of this. So to me, all I hear are numbers.
That is one of the reasons.
Why 308? Like, what is 30-06?
Well,
I'm serious when I say that.
So they're both the same diameter bullet.
Okay.
The 30-06, I believe you can get a little bit heavier and still keep the speed behind it, because it's a little bit, it's a longer. Levi, the 30-06 is a long action cartridge, right?
Yeah, the 30-06 holds significantly more powder than the 308. In the 308, you can function out of a short action. 30-06 is long action.
And one of the things that I like so much about the 308 is that the military used it so extensively. There is an unbelievable amount of ballistic information on the internet about it.
That is a really good point.
If that's what you're starting with, it's really easy to look up the information on it. You don't have to learn it yourself.
I'm guessing that the availability, because the 308 is so popular, anytime you get into a NATO cartridge, and for those who don't know and listening, NATO cartridges are ones that are approved for use, probably the wrong term, but by NATO, like literally the organization NATO.
What's NATO, Philip?
It's a conglomerate of countries that were put together to help fight the spread of communism, basically. but they all kind of settled on like a certain set of cartridges, and the 308 was one of them, right? So to Daryl's point, there's a whole lot of rifles out there. I guarantee you that if somebody makes a precision rifle, long range rifle, bolt action, hunting rifle, semi-automatic, like there's probably a 308 version of it out there.
Yeah.
And the ammunition, I got to imagine too, is probably pretty available. In general, in load data, like you were talking about, Daryl, do you say that's accurate as well?
Yes.
So, Levi, what would you recommend for like a first cartridge for somebody who's looking into for hunting? from so anything, the... anything in the country, I guess. Cause that's a big question, right? Cause one character is like a 223 will, you know, smoke a groundhog, but may not be something you want to think about using with an elk, right?
Yeah. So normally I start off with like, what are their goals? Where do they see themselves going? I start there, and then unfortunately there's not really one cartridge that's going to do it all good. If you step up to say a 300 Win Mag, which is, that's kind of the go-to for a lot of people for elk. Nobody's going to want to learn off of that. That's a hard one to put 100 rounds down in a day without creating a flinch or a sore shoulder. So I usually start, most of the people I kind of steer them towards like a 243, which is basically a neck down 308. So the reason I do that is you have a good enough variety of ammo and bullets. Say you drop down to a 55 grain bullet, that's good for varmints, prairie dog hunting, lots of speed, it's very flat, or you can get up to the, you know, 100 class or 100 grain class of bullets, and you can do deer, you know, reasonable ranges, elk, you know, kind of all of the North American hunting stuff. You know, you'd obviously have to be careful with some of the larger game, but most people get into deer and antelope, stuff like that.
So pretty much like anything in like the Midwestern states, you could take with a 243.
Yeah, yeah, I'd say so.
And then we talk about like neck down cartridge. It's like so you say it's like the 30-06, right? And then it's basically like all the powder that's behind it, but a smaller, lighter bullet. Is that?
Well, so
how would you explain that to people who don't know?
So the 308 shoots a 308 caliber projectile, and all they do for the 243 is basically neck it down to a 6mm bullet, so roughly the same amount of powder. But what you get with that is more speed, you know, especially if you can extend the barrel length on them and use a slower powder, you can gain some good speed, which is flat trajectory, which for most people getting into hunting is, I try to keep it as simple as possible. So, you know, some people are very quick to pick up, you know, dialing your scope. Other people just aren't going to do it. So the 243 kind of gives you an option of a very good max point blank range, which is, for those that don't know, is you basically set your point of impact at 100 yards, 2 to 3 inches high, and then that keeps you inside the vitals of whitetail, most North American animals, and then you basically find out where that bullet drops two to three inches below your point of aim, and that's your maximum range. So you don't have to adjust. Like, you can shoot and you can be in the vitals where you need to be at 50 yards or, you know, 300 yards, and you don't have to try to compensate with your reticle or adjusting your scope. It kind of simplifies it for beginner hunters.
I'll be honest, I never even thought about that concept, because obviously when we shoot like sport or shoot like ARs, for example, we're always taking into consideration dropping into A zone, but I never really translated that concept over to vitals of a animal. And that, to your point, and for somebody new, being able to be on target without having to dial on their reticle would be a lot easier. And then because it is such a fast bullet, I got to imagine that you can get some pretty good range out of it. So if you wanted to translate into longer range shooting and spend a little more time on that longer range shooting, is that something that'll get you out to 1,000 yards as well too, and then just spend time working on getting your dope going for it?
Yeah, so you can get some very high BC 6mm bullets, because it is one of the, you know, bench rest guns. Assuming you have enough twist rate to push what you're looking for. But if you get up into, you know, the 95 grain burgers or some of the new Hornadays, you can easily get to 1,000 yards with those, with the right corrections.
Nice. And then if you're in that space as well too, one thing I know that's easier for a lot of like precision shooters and long range shooters, especially newer ones, is you're looking at something that's a flat shooting bullet. And when I say flat, it's usually something that's really fast that tends to do a pretty good job of like bucking the wind, and that you don't have to necessarily dial as much elevation for. Is a 243 fairly good with that as well too?
Yeah. So there's a give and take everywhere. The faster the bullet and the lighter, it will stay flatter to a certain point. And then because it will be usually a lower BC, then some of the other ones, it will bleed off that speed and get pushed around being lighter by the wind a little bit. So that's where the hunting scenario comes in, is what's good for paper isn't necessarily good for hunting. You know, I prefer on for beginners to have a very fast flat. It's one less thing for them to worry about, but it's not necessarily the best for shooting paper where you know you're going to have to dial it up.
Okay, that makes a ton of sense. And then a question I guess for both of you, and maybe Daryl can take this one first, is one cartridge we hear a lot about is the 6.5 Creedmoor, and maybe more so the newer 6 Creedmoor, but what gave rise to the 6.5 Creedmoor? Like, why is that such a popular round? And is that something that you could, like, let's say I'm a new shooter, or I've been shooting for a while, and I want to get into precision shooting, but I also want a firearm that I could potentially hunt with as well too. Is something like a 6.5 Creedmoor a viable option as well?
Absolutely. The 243 that Levi was just talking about is a 6mm bullet. So the 6.5 Creedmoor is pretty much the same, just a little bit bigger. It has, is very flat shooting. Most of your factory rifles come with a tight enough twist on those barrels that they can handle the higher BC bullets, so they buck the wind quite a bit better. And yes, it's a good target round, and it's a good hunting round.
And I guess with the different rounds, there are different types of bullets that you can purchase, whether or not you're doing precision or hunting. Like, what are those two different types of bullets or multiple types of bullets?
Well, so it's funny you ask that one, because that's actually what gives the 6.5 Creedmoor in the hunting world has a pretty bad rap. A lot of guides don't like it, and part of the downfall is that is everybody was sold on out of the box. You know, it's not the rifle. They're just sold on the caliber. Buy a 6.5 Creedmoor. You can shoot game at 1,000 yards. You know, at one point, I've heard it multiple times, actually, a salesman at Cabela's was trying to sell a guy a 6.5 Creedmoor over a 300 Win Mag, and he said it's exactly the same at 1,000 yards, which, if you look at the drops, they can be very similar, but one of them carries a lot of payload. And what part of it is, you can go in and you can buy very good, high-quality match ammo for shooting paper with a 6.5 Creedmoor. That doesn't necessarily make it the best for hunting animals. So a lot of guys you'll see buy, you know, 147 ELDXs, and oh, they shoot good on paper, and go try to kill animals with them. And it's not necessarily the best choice, but in my opinion.
Would you say that it's just as good as the 243?
I'd say it's a little bit better. I actually, most of my hunting is with that. There's a few reasons for that. The 6.5 kind of falls right in between the sweet spot of the 308 and the 243. And if you kind of looked into the history of the Creedmoor, it was two guys that were shooting competition, and they set out to beat the 308, from what I understand. And they came up with the 6.5 Creedmoor. Bullets have very good sectional density, very high BC. And as you stated, that was kind of the first one where manufacturers were giving you a very good twist rate to shoot the heavy, high BC bullets.
So I know we've mentioned a few times here, you've talked about BC and sectional density. For those of us who are new into the space, what does BC stand for, and what does it do, and then what is like sectional density?
So the BC is ballistic coefficient, and that's basically how much drag the bullet will take, and how, kind of in layman's terms, how it bucks the wind and how good it will do at distance. I'm not super, I've never really educated myself too much on sectional density, other than that helps a lot with on game, you know, performance, from what I understand. That's kind of out of my realm. So I don't know enough on that to
sure
give you specifics. I just know that there's a lot of chatter when guys are talking about on game performance, the sectional density of them.
Interesting. Yeah, because I'd heard a decent amount like about BC, and I think in general it's the higher number of the BC that is better. Is that correct?
Yeah, yes. The better it will perform downrange.
Gotcha. So something else too that I know is a big in selection. Real quick, actually, before we move on to scopes, within a rifle selection, if I'm shooting like bench rest or PRS versus hunting, am I buying a different firearm for either one of those, or is there something that can kind of do duty between the two of them? Like what makes a precision rifle different than a hunting rifle?
Yeah, I would say weight usually, and that's my big one between the two.
Yeah, gotcha. Which comes right along with length. You don't really want a 24-inch barrel on a hunting rifle if you can get it, if you don't need it.
So you're looking at a shorter barrel than I assume for hunting?
Yes. Gotcha. Something that you can move around with better.
Yeah, and a lot of that's, you know, not that you can't dual purpose some of them, but you definitely don't want to start your hike at 10,000 foot of elevation carrying a 12-pound rifle. So, you know, there's a lot, and as he said, barrel length is another one. A lot of the precision stuff, you can get away with a 24, 26 inch barrel, but it gets kind of cumbersome when you're in a hunting scenario.
And then with a precision rifle, I think, is it accurate to say that you're looking for, I guess, like you guys talked about, a longer barrel, but then also having a heavier gun in like precision shooting, like bench rest or PRS or whatever, would you consider that as an actual advantage? Because like I know from shooting pistols, shooting like ARs, that the more weight you have on your firearm in the right places, you tend to get less recoil. Because like if you're hunting, you're basically relying on that single shot, right? So that first shot you get off, like that's going to be it, because otherwise you're scaring your game away most likely after that, I assume. But with something like a PRS or a precision, any kind of precision rifle competition that you have, you're probably looking for something that you can get quick follow-up shots. Is that an accurate statement as well? And what do you look for in a PRS rifle?
Yeah, I don't really. Weight is a big benefit to precision shooting, or you know, being off of a bench, because you don't have to carry it around, and you are shooting more than once, you know, when you're in a competition. So the less recoil, the less it actually will move if you input some force on it.
And then I guess a question for both of you, for hunting and then for precision rifle, suppressors have become very an in vogue thing, right? Is it like putting that on the end of your hunting rifle or precision rifle? Like what are you gaining out of that versus just shooting with like a break?
You don't upset the people next to you.
That's fair.
Yeah, when you use a brake to manage your recoil, the people on the left and the right of you pay the price.
So does the suppressor kind of give you the same function of a brake? It's a lot more pleasant to shoot.
I can't say that a suppressor helps minimize recoil.
Interesting.
But it does make it a lot nicer. Obviously, on your ears and everybody else's.
And I assume the same thing applies for hunting, too, is if you're out in the wilderness and you have to take a shot, you'd be much rather, without ear protection on, you're more likely to not blow your ears out if you do so with a suppressor.
Correct. Yeah, if you're trying to shoot a large capacity 30 caliber or 338, you kind of need a break. And, you know, it's not always optimal. In a perfect world, everybody says, oh, I'd wear hearing protection. But a lot of the times you just forget or something like that. It's definitely a benefit not to hurt your ears. Or most people hunt with partners, especially if you're going after elk. You need to have somebody to help you carry it out usually. So, yeah, it's a courtesy thing.
Gotcha. Darn NFA laws. I always think about it. It's like in any other country, like in Europe or whatever, there's not – like, you just go to the store and buy a suppressor. Now, they can't just go to the store and buy a gun. Of course, you can't do that now in Michigan anymore either. You got to have your CPL and all that stuff, but at least for a pistol. But, like, people always assume that having a suppressor is going to make it completely silent. And there are some cases when, like, a subsonic, you know, 300 blackout maybe, but 22 long rifle subsonic, I've heard that is truly movably quiet. But for your average rifle, you're only really bringing it down to a level that is like maybe hearing safe, and probably not really even hearing safe for that one like initial shot that you'd have to break if you're out hunting, right? You're not gonna blow your ears out, or maybe avoid causing that long-term damage. And it's so funny in a culture of the United States where we're so safety first, the one thing that would save on people's like long-term hearing, you're not allowed to have without permission from the federal government, which is completely ridiculous to me.
I could be wrong on that, but I know that from what I understand, there's a lot of places in Europe that require you to have a suppressor for hunting. As a courtesy, think of when you're hunting, it's very early in the morning or, you know, right at dusk, and nobody wants to be woken up by, a firearm going off either. So,
yeah, no kidding. So right, I guess kind of moving on from the rifles and caliber selection. So when I've done very minor research when it comes to long distance shooting, and I heard something that was very reoccurring, which is when you're choosing your scope, you want a scope that's more expensive than the rifle. Can you guys speak into the validity of that? Like, is that true? Is that really a thing?
I think it really depends on what you're going for.
Okay.
There is plenty of guys out there that will buy a much, much cheaper scope than what their rifle is. And it goes back to what you're doing. If you know you're just going to be bench shooting during the day, the glass quality is not nearly as important as in a hunting scenario. Those guys are looking for a scope that just tracks true. You know, you can dial up, dial back down to zero, and it's going to hit zero. When you get into a hunting scenario, I'd say that, yeah, that's a good rule of thumb. Spend as much on your scope or more as you do on the rifle, because you're trying to get everything together at that point. You're trying to get the best glass, because again, most of your hunting scenarios are going to be, you know, right at daylight, right at dusk, and you still need it to track true, because you don't get a spotting shot. You know, unfortunately with hunting, usually you get to, oh, there it is, range it, dial, and hopefully your scope does its job.
Gotcha. So here's a question for both of you, Levi and Daryl. So can you give me like three options for scopes? I have like bottom, bare bones budget, mid tier, and you know what? This is straight up Gucci. Like if I had all the money in the world, this is a scope I want. If you can give me like a okay, better, and best option for scopes, what would you tell me to get?
I would start with Leupold and Vortex are very, very close for me at the bottom end of the scale. And then above the what I prefer and is Night Force for both for glass clarity and for tracking. I have three of them now on different rifles. And every one of them, you can dial up, like Levi is talking about, you can dial up full range, dial right back to zero, and it's never moved. They're so repeatable.
And when you talk about tracking, like, what do you mean by tracking? Like, for somebody who's new, what are they looking for in that tracking? And you kind of talked about dialing up and down, and how does that relate to the like tracking concepts?
So we're getting into a little bit of the dope card here that you just talked about, but yeah. So when you go out at distance, your bullet is not, we talk about it flying flat, but it is not. It's going in an arc. So the farther out you go, the higher you have to aim, so the bullet drops in at the right spot. So when you So take my 308, for instance, at 500 meters, when we're doing the silhouette shoots, I am aiming 72 inches above the target.
Wow.
So I dial my scope up in what they call MOA or minute of angle up to 72 inches so that my crosshairs of the scope remain on the target, but the barrel of the rifle is raised. And that's what I mean by dialing up. And then if I, you know, to come back to 100 yards where my zero is, I can dial it right back down to zero, and it's right on the money.
Gotcha. So interesting that you bring up MOA. I know there's also MRAD. Can you guys talk about the difference between those two? What is that?
Like Milarad, the difference between MOA and Milarad is basically the same thing as standard and metric. So Milarad deals with meters and MOA deals with yards.
So what do you prefer to use?
I prefer MOA. Only because,
I do also.
Well, that was Levi?
Yes.
Yeah, that was Levi.
I love you.
Did you guys just become best friends?
I was really hoping Levi would say, I prefer MRAD.
I know.
And Daryl's like, MOA? Is like, yes, let's have a war. Let's go.
Well, yeah. I'm trying. Yeah. I just put one on a 243 AR-10, and I struggle with it. My brain works in inches and yards. Mm-hmm. So, you know, MOA just works for me.
It works for me. That's what I learned.
Us Americans, man.
But it
we're stubborn.
I would like to get Levi's take on this because I don't want to get too far into the math, but for most of your MOA scopes, each click is a quarter MOA. Okay.
Correct.
So, and each, in a Milarad scope, each click is a tenth of a mil. And if you do the math out at 1,000 yards, or even doesn't even need to be at that distance, but a quarter MOA is less of a movement than a tenth of a mil, which tells me that it's more accurate.
Interesting. I've actually
I thought it was the other way around too. I did not realize that. Tyler, we learned something new today. We can go home.
Let's go.
That's the whole point of this, bro.
Let's go out to 1,000 yards. A quarter MOA at 1,000 yards is 2.5 inches. A tenth of a mil at 1,000 yards is 3.6.
Huh.
So the adjustments that you make are more precise.
I feel really dumb because the last long range scope I bought was a mil radian. Now I feel like I need to send it back in and
They're definitely usable. They're definitely usable. I'm more comfortable with MOA, and that's one of the reasons.
For me, it's easy too because if you're looking at it, minute of angle is roughly as close as you're going to get 1 inch per 100 yards. So if 400 yards, that math makes sense. If you need to come up X amount, you can just divide it by 4, and that gives you your clicks. So in my brain, it works. Milrad is just it's much harder to learn for me.
I think the reason why mils became at least popular at all versus MOA, because MOA I think dominated for such a long time because hunters were using MOA. I think mils became popular. I think they're using the military exclusively. I think because of the fact that everybody uses meters, the metric system in the military versus using miles or yards like we do in the United States.
They're all wrong.
So a quick Google search does tell me that Daryl is right. So
of course he's right.
Yeah, I know he is, but because a tenth of a mil is 0.36 inches and a quarter MOA is about a quarter inch.
Huh.
Well, and that's kind of what I struggled with. It's basically thirds instead of quarters. So yeah, for me,
that is true.
It was much more difficult to try to do the math in my head, than for MOA. And I blame that on public school.
Yeah, I get that, man. I really get that.
Well, I went through private school, and I feel the same way. So,
it's the American education system, guys. That's what it is.
There you go.
I know. My dad used to have very small tangent, but he used to have these collection of posters because he worked for the federal government. He had a collection of posters because I think at one point the U.S. government was trying their best to convert the American people from the imperial system to the metric system. They used to have this whole campaign where they had an eagle that was the metric system is coming, you can count on it. My dad thought it was hilarious. We used to collect all the posters, and I think at some point they just completely gave up.
No kidding.
And and it's decided that they can't make it happen. Now, if you're in the military, obviously you spend a lot of time working with the metric system.
I would say that was probably late 70s.
That sounds about right.
I remember it.
Well, if anybody's looking to buy a Ares BTR Gen 2 Mil Radian scope, I've got one for sale now. I'm switching to MOA.
Well, the good news is, funny. If you're like me, you know, once you get everything dialed in, it won't matter because you're looking at a chart, right? So if it tells you, you know, three, you're just dialing three. You don't actually, you know, look at it. I just started playing with my first one, and I had to make a shot on a pig at just over 500 yards. And boy, you should have saw the panic come over my face. Like, oh boy. And then I was like, well, looked at the app, and, you know, that is a good part of it is, you know, it all translates to numbers. So if it tells you to come up four, and you're pretty good.
That is a very good point, Levi.
Yep. So I'm glad you brought that up because I know Daryl brought it up too. So what is a dope chart? What is that?
Let's see if I can remember this.
Yeah, what does dope stand for? Even before that, that's a good point.
Data.
What does dope stand for?
Data on previous engagement. It's a military term. So yes, a dope chart is data off previous engagement. So every time you go out, or not every time you go out, but when you build a new round for your rifle, you want to go out and measure its trajectory at different distances and then note them in your dope book. So you can go back to that page for, you know, certain weather, because you take into consideration the temperature, the barometric pressure, the wind, the altitude, all of that stuff. So if you're taking a shot at 500 yards, you want to go back. And in those weather conditions, you can go back to that page and figure out what your come up was or how many clicks you needed to raise your reticle and repeat that shot.
So real quick on that, there's been a competition I've been following for a while that I would love to do, but probably never will be able to be skilled enough to do. But it's called the Mammoth Sniper Challenge. And they ran it, and I don't know what they run anymore because it was taken over by Vortex and somebody else. But they used to run it, and it was run in either late fall or really early spring. And they were talking about how they had to have guys go out in advance to re-zero their rifles. Re-zero, and then check their dope cards, because like a lot of people take the temperature, you know, at like 60, 70 degrees, whatever, when it's like average temperature, but it was so cold that it was making such a massive impact at long range distance. I could not believe that was the case. I thought that people that were in precision rifle were just being like, the serious mathematician, or like, I have to do math and my sport is very difficult because we have to take the consideration of the temperature. But it really does. It makes a massive difference of where your round is on target, especially the further out you go.
Yes, it can. Basically, you're dealing with the density of the air, you know, with temperature. So the lower the temperature, the more dense the air is. So the more resistance your bullet is going to encounter going through it.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. That's very interesting. I didn't realize it gets denser as it gets colder.
Well, it's like the molecule slow down, I guess, but yeah, interesting.
And your elevation will play a huge part in it too.
Certainly. Certainly.
Your drop card made for here. Like, I've got to make a new one before I go out west. And I kind of wing it. So I tape one to the side of my I tape one to the side of my stock and try to pick kind of in the middle of where I'm going to hunt, and within reason, you know, it lands you there. Like, say 1,000 foot of elevation, it will usually land you on target, or it has for me. So you just got to get it close. But if I did the same, you know, 300 foot of above sea level, and my 800 yard hit here would be significantly different than say where I start at 9,000 feet when I go to Colorado, because that air is very, very thin.
Very thin.
Huh. So, okay, so let's say that I'm new into this, and I'm limited. I've got like 100, you know, yard or 200 yard range, and I can collect data at those distances. Like, how can I, is there any way to create, like, using, like, I don't know, modern technology or whatever, is there any way that I can get rough dope data in advance that then I can potentially prove out later? So, but at least I can get like a rough estimate.
That's actually what I use. I was going to tell you, that's probably about the most tech that I will use. But I use a program called Applied Ballistics, okay. Yep. By Brian Litz, another Michigander.
I did not know that. I've heard of Applied Ballistics, but I didn't know it was developed by a Michigander.
Yeah. He's got it dialed in. So his extrapolates a lot of the math for you. So I make it very easy for myself. Is I'll do, you can do it two ways. Like, I punch in a preset dope card. Like, I'll look at the weather where I'm going to go, and I'll say, hey, this is the average temperature. This is the elevation I should be at. And that gets me one that I can tape to the side of my stock. That way, if I have a, like, if I've got to make it happen quick, I'm right there. If I've got lots of time or I'm shooting a steep angle, I can also pull it off my phone, which will ping off of usually the closest tower and load all the weather data, stuff like that. Now keep in mind, every rifle, as you're rifling cuts into the bullet, will affect the BC, and every bullet's not made exactly the same. So that's what I do to get close. And then you can, in a perfect world, and what you should do before you go to attempt to take game at distance is, you know, go check those. Like, if it tells you that, you know, you need, you know, 30 minute of angle, you should definitely go out and dial up 30 minute and see where it's actually at and make the appropriate adjustments to your BC or your speed or whatever you need to do at that point.
Because it seems like dumb to almost say this out loud, but I mean, obviously the further out you get, like, the more difficult things for, like, predicting where your bullet's going to go are, right? Like, because like you're saying earlier, you can kind of fudge a lot of data. Like, you're talking about the 243, you kind of fudge a lot, like, you know, at 100 to 200 or 300, right? But I feel like the further you go out, every like 100 yards that you add, you're adding a lot of complexity. Would you say that that is also accurate as well, too? Just because you're looking at, like, the bullet slowing down, you know, the wind changes, those kind of things.
Yeah, so I actually got, I'm glad you said that, because I got the, when I first started getting into it, I was struggling with not being able to shoot real long range, being from Michigan here. And the first gentleman that built my first semi-custom rifle was Bobby Hart, and he's won all kinds of awards for long range shooting, very accomplished. And I got to talk to him on the phone, and he made the best comment. He said, well, what's the difference between, you know, 300 yards where you're shooting and 1,000 yards? And I'm, you know, doing the math in my head, and he very simply said, it's just more minute of angle. Yeah. And I said, okay, that it's all math at that point. If you know your BC and you know your velocity coming out of there, your drop is all math. And he said, the reason he tells people that is because at 300 yards, you need to start working on all of your fundamentals as far as shooting. You need to have your drop needs to be right. You need to start calling wind, you know, starting to at that distance. And that really kind of settled me down and was like, all right, yeah, this is doable. And, you know, it is just math. Trust the math on it. And then the wind call is the hardest. That's the one that's always going to be a variable. You know, it's not going to be the same where you're shooting to where the bullet's going. That's the tough one for me anyway.
Yeah, I have a hard time with that too. And that kind of goes back to my opening statement about mid-range and long range, because, you know, when you get into the mid-range, now you're like Levi is saying, you're starting to talk about wind. You're starting to talk, make sure that your gun is level when you pull the trigger. The temperature, the barometric pressure. But when you get into long range, now you're talking about the spin of the earth and all that other, what that, there's a Coriolis effect that I can't even tell you what it means, but there's the farther out you go, the longer the list gets of external forces on your bullet.
That's wild. And like, I know, like, even like spin drift too, because the bullet obviously spins in one direction. Eventually it'll spin itself off to, like, you know, the right or left, depending on how the barrel is cut. But that stuff is all extremely fascinating to me. And I feel like, and before we hopped on this, we were talking about like extreme long range shooters where it's, there is like a point at which you're just kind of lobbing them in there and you're hoping for the best because there's way too many things to consider shooting that far out. One of them I know too is like when you're shooting, you want your bullet to remain supersonic as far as long as possible. Cause I guess it, when you go from like the supersonic to subsonic, there's in that transonic area that really messes with what the bullet does.
Yep.
And it's really hard to predict of what it's doing. So I mean, I'm assuming that you're like, that's kind of why I would still, and I know you said like 1,000 yards is really mid range, but for somebody shooting like a 6.5 Creedmoor, you know, like 1,000 yards, they're still going to be supersonic, but I think out to maybe 1,300 yards, they're still supersonic, but that's when things start getting really fuzzy. And that's when you start having some issues where you just can't predict stuff like you can mathematically before.
Right.
With, like using ballistic calculators and, you know, getting a rough idea of where the wind's at and those kind of things.
Yeah. And that, a lot, that has to do with your bullet selection too. Because like with the 308, you're shooting a 168 grain bullet, it pretty much goes transonic around the 800 yard mark. In order to get out to 1,000, you have to go up to 175 grain bullet. So you have more weight to carry it out there.
Interesting.
Bullet design will play a factor in that too. And how fast you're spinning it will, a lot of that will affect when it leaves, you know, supersonic.
I didn't even think about that either, but I guess it makes sense because, you know, I'm assuming that the, is it the more you're spinning it then typically, like the longer it'll take to go?
Yeah, well, it should in, I don't know, in theory. The form of the bullet, and I'm no expert. I don't make bullets. I am not, definitely not Brian Litz. But that's just kind of what I gathered from, you know, some of the long range forums and companies like Hammer Bullets that are designing new ones every day and kind of the struggles that they've had.
Interesting. Yeah. You mentioned Brian Litz. Is he the guy that's like, you mentioned from Michigan, he's the ones that works for, I forget, one of the major bullet manufacturers that's like a god among men when it comes to bullet design?
Yes. Yeah, he worked for, if I believe he's the lead ballistician for Burger Bullets.
That sounds right. Interesting. So I guess that actually brings us into our kind of our last gear topic. I know we kind of bounced around a little bit there, but as a somebody who wants to get into this, your option for shooting a lot is factory ammo, but at what point are you looking to make that transition to reloading?
As soon as possible.
you're here, folks. Don't even bother.
There's the answer ammo. Right there.
I will back that up a little bit because I have the equipment to do so, but I don't reload yet for rifle rounds. And I have a not a very expensive bolt action firearm, but it is in 6.5 Creedmoor, and it is very picky when it comes to ammo, and it loves Federal Match because it's the most expensive, right? And there's, I think there's a lot of to be said that a crappy barrel probably can be made up with a good bullet. Maybe not. I don't know. You guys may know more about that. But it really likes Federal Match, which is expensive until Palmetto came around and made their own bullet based around the Federal Match round for 6.5 Creedmoor. But why would you want to be something that you get into reloading for precision?
So to qualify what I said, okay, the rifle that I put together, my 308 that I modeled after the M40, is nothing more than a factory Remington 700 police model, which has a heavy barrel, 20-inch barrel. I bought the barreled action, and I put it on a fiberglass stock. I hand-lapped the rifling to get rid of the machine marks, and that was about all I did to it. It would shoot at 100 yards. It would shoot with the ammo I was feeding it, 1 inch, maybe an inch and a half groups, no matter what I was using. After I took the hand loading class up at Marksmanship Training Center and used what I learned there to build a round that the rifle liked, the best group I shot measured 0.186. So less than a quarter of an inch for three shots.
Sheesh. So for those who are new into this, in general, consensus is you're looking for anything out to 1,000, you probably want an MOA gun, which basically means that it'll shoot a group under an MOA.
Sub-MOA, yes.
Yep.
Yes.
But to be shooting that small of a group is extremely good. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes, it is. And it's the rifle. It's not me. Every firearm I have shoots better than I do. I'm going to tell you that right now.
That's fair. That's fair. Do you own a High Point?
No, I don't.
There you go.
And I wouldn't tell you if I did.
fair.
There you go.
I look at the reloading.
Go ahead. So there's a thing in rifle barrels called harmonics. Basically, every time you fire a round, that barrel is vibrating. Okay? So the closer you get your round, when you hand load, you want to make your rounds the same speed as one another so that it comes out of the crown or comes out of the end of the barrel at the same point in that flex every time. That's where you get your accuracy from.
And I know we were recently out shooting. We had a mutual friend of a few of us on the podcast that was shooting from a very nice rifle, and he was getting awful groups, and it was very concerning for him because, you know, it was a really good scope, it was a really good rifle, and he was like, "What the heck?" You know, and you get to the moment of panic where you're like, "Man, I spent all this money on this really nice setup." You know, it's not a custom setup, but it's still a lot of dollars, right? I think it was Bergera, I think. And then I stepped over, and it was 6.5, and I noticed, and I was, "What are you shooting?" And he was shooting like Aguila 6.5 Creedmoor, and I had the exact same experience with that ammo, where I was getting like four MOA groups at 100 yards with that exact ammo.
Did you ever put that on a chronograph, Phil?
The Aguila stuff.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I'd have to look back at my data. I think I did. If I remember correctly, I think it was all over the place.
I'd be very interested to find out what the extreme spread on that was, because I'm sure it was wide. And that's what I'm getting at, is if you've got a bullet that's leaving the barrel 100 feet per second off of what the next shot is, there's no way they're going to hit the same mark.
Especially as you move out in distance.
Mm-hmm. So some of the reloading that it sounds like is the barrel harmonics. I've heard a lot of that being very important in the past, even prior to this podcast. But then I think a lot of it is getting like your load to be consistent velocity. And Levi, I know that you also reload a ton, way more than probably like anyone I know. I assume, again, my first question, I guess, is how important is it to make sure that the amount of grain of powder you're putting in there is like, you have to be within a certain whatever. But what else are you looking for when you're developing that round?
For me, I started into reloading a little bit different for a different reason. Most people get in it to save money, which is laughable on my end of it. it's definitely never going to be there. I got into it just because we live in a great time where we're getting custom machine lathed bullets. So I was looking at getting a very specific bullet in a very specific rifle. So that allowed me to pick, say I wanted a bullet of this, you know, I wanted a bullet to do this. I could buy that bullet and get it loaded into, say, my 6.5 Creedmoor and have the terminal performance on game out of that bullet that nobody else loaded. So that's kind of what drew me into it. And then, you know, obviously as you learn and progress, you learn how to, you know, tighten up the groups and get everything kind of working together. So mine started off more as I want a very specific bullet, 'cause I'm kind of a weirdo when it comes to that. And then it's like, oh, all right. And then once you figure out how to make, you know, you pick the bullet and then kind of build the load to shoot into said rifle.
Interesting. And how long do you guys spend on like load development getting just right, and what are the things that you're changing from one load to another?
Well, for me, I can, it depends. So I've really shortcutted that now. Is a lot of that will depend on, you know, how picky you want to be and bullets. So I've had some bullets that I've gotten fantastic groups out of, and they work great, but I'm chasing, you know, not only the charge weight of the powder loaded into them, but cartridge overall length, you know, how far the bullet jumps until it engages the rifling. Recently, I've switched almost all of my hunting stuff over to hammer bullets, and now I don't spend a lot of time. I can have a complete load done pretty easily in an afternoon. I run a charge ladder, and I find pressure. I'll back off, and then usually somewhere around there, I can get a very, very good group, because that bullet, those bullets in general, don't tend to care about the how far they're seated off the lands. They're very insensitive to that, similar to kind of a flat-based bullet. So a lot of them I can get done pretty quickly.
That's interesting. That goes way different from anything I've ever tried in the past. It takes me forever to figure that stuff out. Daryl, I'm curious about your process as well, too, if you find it to be similar or if you do things a little bit different from like a load development perspective.
It's kind of similar. I figure out what my chamber for whatever rifle I'm doing, figure out what my chamber length is and measure to the ogive of the bullet. Back it off probably 5/1000ths from the lands, and then I don't move it again. And the biggest thing that I'm changing, and I figure out what the neck tension needs to be so that is always the same. The chamber length,
all of this, because this is all very this is where like my knowledge level starts to really fall so off there, in the how to reload for a rifle.
So there's a gate. There's a tool that you can buy, and I actually made my own because I'm just that Dutch. you take a fired brass and you drill it out and tap it so that it goes on the end of this rod, and then there's another rod that goes up the center of it so that you can push it into the chamber and push the rod forward with a bullet till it hits the lands. And then lock it down, pull it out. So now you know the exact dimension from the base of the cartridge to the ogive of the bullet, which is where it starts to taper, where the part that will contact the lands when it's fired, the rifling, I guess I should say. And then I back that off 5/1000ths, and that's where I set my seating depth at. The bad part about that is that I can only use certain bullets because the higher, real high ballistic coefficient ones will be at that point will be too long to go in my magazine because the overall length will be too long to run through the action. But I've had the best luck with Berger bullets because they have a high coefficient, but they're still kind of a shorter bullet. And once that is all set, then I will go through, I'll look at the load data or the what the manufacturer says I should use for my minimum and maximum powder charge. And I will pick I will pick right in the middle, go 5 rounds down, I guess, from the middle and 5 rounds up. So in 1/10 of a grain in increments. 2/10 of a grain, excuse me. And a grain is just the weight of measure. Mm-hmm. So I'm having a hard time explaining this. I understand.
No, actually, I actually understand it. So then you're grouping those different at different grain weights, right?
Yes. So I will load, you know, basically 30 rounds. So there's 3 rounds at one weight, go up 2/10 of a grain, 3 rounds there, go up 2/10 of a grain, 3 rounds there. On up to my stopping point, and then I'll go out and I will fire them from a sled. So it's not me, it's the rifle. All I do is press the trigger. Everything else is sandbagged and all that. figure out which one gives me the best group, and then I will go back, load up some more, and drop down 1/10 and go up 1 more 1/10 and see if I get any better solutions. But that's right about where I'm going to stay.
And that sounds like go ahead.
That's how I developed the load that for the rifle.
It sounds like a lot of time and dedication. Like, I'm legit really impressed.
It's, I mean, once not you... really that bad. I mean, you can load, I can load those 30 rounds in an hour. Once I get the dimensions of the cartridge set, I can load those rounds in an hour and then go out to the range and take an hour to shoot them. So that's not that bad.
I will throw in there that is actually how I used to do mine. And I've kind of moved on to, it seems like more and more people are doing that just to save components with, the current environment. So I should have added on mine is, I know that the bullets that I shoot tend to like 20/1000ths of a jump from the lands. I find my lands a little bit different. I actually have the same tool that he does, but I found it, for me, it's been easier to put very little pressure on the case neck, and then I will start the bullet, and then I will just cam over my bolt, and I'll pull those out, and I'll take 5 to 10 measurements and find, they all pretty much end up, in the same area, within 1/1000ths, and that will tell me kind of where my lands are at, and then I'll back off 20/1000ths. I'll look just like he did, find the book you're looking at for where to start your charge weight, and I'll go up in 0.5-grain increments. And I think the part that I left out that is somewhat important is as I'm shooting those to find pressure, I'm also tracking the velocity of each one of those. And a lot of the times you will see the velocity make pretty steady jumps, 25 to 50 feet per second as your charge goes up. And where that levels off or where those get closer is usually what's called a node. And that's kind of where I look at. And usually if you find pressure and back off, say I'm loading a Creedmoor and it's 40 grains of Varget and I find pressure at 40.5 or 41. If you back off, that's usually lines up with where your two shots, say it be 39.5 and 40 for your charge weight. Those will be very similar in speed. And then I'll play, I'll load up a 3-shot group there. If it shows promise, then I'll do very similar to what Daryl does, and I'll go on each side of that with a 3-to-5-shot group, and then just fine-tune it from there. And then if some guys can, you can spend forever chasing your tail and getting tinkeritis with that and playing with seating depth, but and it all depends on what you're going to want to do with it. If you're bench rest shooting, you have to kind of do that. For hunting, you have to take into consideration, say a 6.5 Creedmoor, the bullet that I have, it runs out of speed for what I consider useful on elk around 650 to 680 yards. And I just need to be able to hit that target. So if I can keep it under a minute of angle, that puts me under 6 inches easily in the vital. But I luckily, I always strive for more, and I try to get, the nice clover leaf, and most all of my loads will end somewhere under 0.5 minute of angle.
So this all sounds like complex, and I think there is a lot of work to be done in this space where, like, as a new shooter trying to figure out how to get that reloading. But I think it's a point where they just have to accept the fact that if you are going to shoot any kind of precision or long range, that you're going to have to get into reloading at some point. But like you said earlier, we're kind of the golden age.
The past 10 minutes, everything just went over my head. I'm like, I have no idea.
That was actually my question was, so if I, like, what kind of resources did you guys use to learn all of this? And you don't have to get very in depth, but like, if there's like a certain guide or a YouTube channel or whatever that who somebody wants to really dig into figuring out how to do this from like start to finish, like where did you guys go? Or is there not one place? There's like a multitude of locations.
I bought a reloading manual and read that. and then kind of slowly work up, because the precision will come second. And I'm sure that this is probably kind of what happened with Daryl, as you get into kind of getting the process figured out, and then the fine tuning. And even to this day, I mean, I'm clearly no expert, but I reach out to a lot of different people, and it's like, hey, this is a very specific issue I'm having. You know, what's your thoughts on it? And there's 100 ways to skin a cat, and usually somebody will tell you something you didn't know, and you try it, and it works.
There you go.
Huh. Yeah. So, and I'm guessing there's probably like different reloading forums and like Reddit. Yeah. I know, I'm sure that can be a cesspool sometimes of information. But my guess is there's some locations online where people are like really dedicated into that craft in that space.
That's actually where I met our mutual friend Nathan. Was both of us were digging for certain information on, you know, load data or a certain process.
What site was that you guys were using? I don't know if that place is even around anymore.
Long Range Hunting. Long Range Hunting That's Online or yeah. Long Range Hunter Online, something like that. I'd have to look back at it. And
yeah, and I think those, like that kind of place is, you know, finding those locations and online forums where the people are like, they're really, it's like, again, like Reddit has some good useful information, but again, there's a lot of trolls on there. But finding those guys that are like dedicated to the craft, who are going to be able to answer those questions, is probably really important. And finding something where there is like intention behind assisting other people or learning more knowledge is I'm sure very important. And there's a few like, you know, reloading YouTube channels, like Ultimate Reloader. He talks a lot about that kind of stuff, and does a pretty good job of walking through how to do that. And there's a million guides out there too for how to, again, online, how to shoot. I know that like, we talked about Warrior Poet Society before. Is it Ryan Kleckner,
Tyler? Ryan Kleckner, yep.
Yep.
Yeah. He's got a book, I think. I forgot what it's called, though. Long Range Shooter's Guide, I think.
Yeah, and that's a great place to start, too, potentially, as well.
Yep, I've watched a lot of his stuff. I've also gotten a lot of information from, I don't know his real name, but his YouTube thing is Tivistorus Rex.
Reviews. Yep, I'm familiar with him.
He's got his early stuff is great. He's gotten a little bit political as of late, but and I'll tell you, when I got into reloading, I started with pistol, and like Levi said, I read the manual and kind of learned how to do it from the manual. But when it came to the precision stuff, I got to tell you, the class up at Marksmanship Training Center was the best. It was the best thing I ever did.
That's awesome.
Huh. Yeah, I guess another point is that you can learn a lot online, but then there is also that, like, there's a lot to be said about having somebody show you. Because, like, I reload for pistol, and I mentioned our mutual friend before, and he was actually the guy that taught me how to reload for pistol. And I've been reloading pretty much, like, what he taught me from the start and have had some good luck. And I've tweaked it, changed my bullets from one brand to another. You know, I'm still in the same powder and that kind of stuff. But you kind of find that person that will show you how to get there. And then learning beyond what they've taught you or to get into the space that you're interested. There's a lot to be said to the community. And we talk a lot about the community on this podcast too. And you're always going to have those people who are going to be helpful to you. I would say probably more so than not. And again, I know we talked about the whole imposter syndrome coming on here, but like these two guys, I'm sure would be a great resource for anybody who would ask them to assist with reloading. And I'm sure they've helped people in the past. I know I've asked Levi some stuff before, same thing with Daryl. But kind of wrapping up the podcast real quick, what are the kind of closing remarks, whether that be like advice, gear, things that we didn't talk about or concepts or even like the next steps for an individual who wants to get into long range or precision, you know, rifle shooting, I guess we'll start with Daryl. Like, what are your kind of thoughts on that in closing?
Don't mess around with the cheap stuff. Buy once, cry once.
In that regards to like a rifle, scope, reloading,
all of it. Yeah, you will. If you buy cheaper equipment, you will spend so much time chasing your tail, you'll probably get right out of it.
Interesting. Yeah, and it's probably more so than any other of the shooting sports, because I feel like we talked about this in a recent podcast where you can buy like a pistol And again, we're in the golden age, a lot of stuff. You can buy a pistol and it's probably going to shoot if it's like a name, major name brand. But if you're really looking to get something precise, it sounds like you can't just buy a cheap rifle off the shelf and expect it to do really well.
No. And one other thing I guess we didn't really touch on, but if you're buying something and putting it together and you've never mounted a scope before, do some research on how to do it or get somebody to help you with it, because you can't, there's a whole lot more to it than just screwing down the mounts and putting the scope on there.
Is that why I keep missing?
If you buy something from the store.
I wouldn't blame that on a scope mount.
Ouch. There we go.
Well, that's why we call ourselves the Acceptable Accuracy Podcast, not the Precise Accuracy Podcast.
There we go.
Even if you buy something off of the rack, have it checked, because odds are that scope was put on that rifle by somebody, by a salesman at that store, and it probably wasn't done right.
Huh. I guess
I would agree. I fix those every year.
Wow.
Right, I'm bringing you guys all my rifles.
Well, and I'd have to say that if you're never going to shoot, you know, if you're not going to shoot very far, or if you're realistically, if you're not going to dial up, it's not as big a deal. But the minute you start doing that, you know, and I think you should make that point, is as you're dialing up, it's going to drift off to one side or the other, because your reticle is not going up in a straight line. It's going off to the side if your scope isn't mounted correctly.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the factory stuff, even the bases, don't come snug down quite a bit. You know, a lot of times people can't figure out and take it apart, and you realize that, you know, two of the four screws are loose.
Mm-hmm.
So always good to strip them down and start from scratch. And
absolutely.
And I would have to add, I think he's spot on with, you know, buy once. You know, I've done that way too many times. You know, it's kind of embarrassing. I still do it to this day, where I'll buy something to. As a matter of fact, I just bought a handheld thermal last week that I was like, I'm going to try it for the price, and I regret that. So
I come by that information honestly, Levi.
I think that between what he said, and I would say try to figure out what your goals are first. Because as those, you know, those may change as you go, but I see a lot of guys jump right in and buy what their buddy told them, which, you know, if your goal is to, hey, you know, realistically, I want to hunt deer out to 500 yards, that's going to be a completely different goal, and you're going to want to buy different equipment than you would for a 1,000-yard bench rest gun.
Certainly.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's really great information about the buy once, cry once too, and what the purpose is behind the purchase that you're making. I'm very much guilty too of, like, when I first getting firearms, and a lot of it too has a lot to do with your economic situation, right? Like, there is a lot to be said about maybe saving a little bit longer and then getting something. I mean, obviously there's going to be a cutoff line between, like, precision rifle that's going to cost you $1,000 versus a precision rifle that's going to cost you like $5,000, right? Like, not everybody's going to be able to go out and afford that.
Right.
Now, I know, like, the Ruger precision rifle was one of those rifles that was truly on that list of, like, oh my gosh, I can spend $1,000 and I can get a rifle that I can shoot in PRS, and it will probably do better than a rifle did 10 years ago that cost twice as much. Right. Now, I don't know the state of, you know, what rifles are recommended anymore today, but, yeah. Anyway, you're gonna say that.
I think it would be the same for scopes too. You know, kind of back on those, is I'm right there with Daryl. I recommend everybody, you know, on the lower end, you know, and luckily Vortex has all of them. You know, very low end, mid range, and they have some incredible glass. Same thing with Leupold. But yeah, I recommend something in, you know, something that's functional for what they're doing, and then. I prefer, right now I'm on a Burris kick for, you know, mid-range stuff. It's pretty good. And then I agree with him as far as my higher-end optics. I'll either run a March or a Night Force. Both of those I really like.
Yeah, and I always find it amazing to me that, like, you can spend, like, anywhere from, you know, like, a couple $100 for just, like, a basic hunting scope that'll probably serve you just fine at, like, 100 to 200 yards, right, all the way up to, like, 5,000 plus on glass, right? And obviously the further out you want to go and the more precise you want to get, the better you're going to, or more you're going to be spending on glass to get there.
Yeah, and, right. And it goes back to like what are your goals? Because you can get into, you know, if you're very careful, zero stops not as important. You know, tracking's probably the number one if you're target shooting long range. You just kind of got to pick where you want to go. The Night Force SHV, I'm fairly fond of those. I've made some fairly long shots with that, and that's a pretty good bang for your buck.
Yes, it is.
It is no ATCAR though.
No, it's not. No, it's not even the NXS. I mean, I've got two NXSs and one ace. What is SHV? Yeah, but
I've got one of the SHVs on a 300 Win Mag, and then I've got the 7x35 ATACR.
Oh boy!
On my 375, and yeah, there's obviously a difference there, but you also there's a big difference in the price tag too.
Oh, Tyler, yeah. do you have any of those, Tyler?
Dude, all I'm hearing are letters right now.
I know. I'm lost. Like, I know a good chunk of the Vortex line, like, but I'm they've gone into the full on like I could buy this or a small used car.
Well, I know where you're going with this, and you also have to be careful. We're gonna recommend Night Force, but if you're gonna do that Wolverine 5K, Night Force are heavy. Gotcha. So I'm not in good enough shape to haul that much weight around. Hence, I build very light rifles or have them built for me. And then that's where I lean more towards my March scopes is they've got a very wide power. So like the one that I run on my 30 Sherman, which is one of my main hunting rifles, is a 2.5x25. And it's, I want to say it's like 23 or 24 ounces. And it has very, very good glass also. So there's a lot of options. We're lucky to live right now.
Yeah,
you know, somebody made a comment too, and I know I talked about guns being like, you know, like 10 years ago versus like the way they are now, or 20 years ago, or whatever. But like glass is that same way. Like, if you look at a like maybe like a mid-range scope today versus a mid-range or like a high-end scope 20 years ago, I mean, you'd probably have a hard time telling the difference, other than maybe things being like tracking and zero stop. But from a glass clarity perspective.
Even the cheap ones today are much better. My dad's got some of the real high-end ones from the late 80s, early 90s, and you look through them now, you're like, even the $100 scopes we have now are seem better in glass.
That's amazing. Wow.
But if you're ever interested, you should look, you know, kind of do some digging, and as far as how long range progress, it seems like they always flip-flop, you know, the cartridge to glass. You know, they started off when scopes first came out, the cartridges were much better. And then you got such good scopes that you could, you know, get much bigger cartridges. And now we find ourselves in the days of, you know, Shytax and other things, because now we can see the targets that we have.
Huh. But the bullets can't get you there yet.
They tend to kind of jump back and forth. And
interesting.
I mean, that's how we ended up with 4,000-yard shots that some people make.
That's right? Still insane. Right? Wow.
Yeah, and it goes right back to the mid-range, long-range thing. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, long-range was 15 to 2,000 yards, but because of the advancements in our equipment, that's no longer the case.
I do have to say that. That's the cartridge and the whole setup. I brought a friend of mine to Texas one year, and he doesn't shoot a whole lot. I put him behind my 375, and he went from 400 right out to, I want to say, the 900-yard gong. And we were talking 10-inch gongs, and he was nailing every one of them. And it kind of gave him that false sense of confidence of, I was doing all the dial-up and making sure everything was level for him, all the beginner stuff, kind of teaching him as I went. But then when he climbed back behind a regular rifle, he realized, you know, there is something to the rifle also.
Oh, absolutely.
We had that Wolverine 5K, which Daryl's probably going to bring up, but because it's a team event, you can like, and you basically, you have like one rifle that you can share between the team. And we opted to use Daryl's because he was so dialed into it, and he would literally dial it for us, and we would just pull the trigger, which was made our lives a lot easier. And then even the year previous, before Brent and Daryl joined our team, we had a guy that was on our squad that had, I forget what the caliber was, but it was some Magnum cartridge. And it was so like flat, you were talking about flat shooting a lot, it was so flat shooting that he hardly had to dial that puppy out to 1,000. Like, I feel like he hardly touched the scope on it. But the thing was like, literally, it was so extremely dialed in that I'm shooting at 1,000 yards, hitting targets with ease, and it gives you that false sense of like confidence. Like, oh yeah, this is not that hard. But then you think about all the work that he put in for the cartridge development, you know, getting the dope, getting it dialed in, all the things to get there is a lot of time. Real quick, Tyler, do you have any closing remarks about long range or precision shooting?
Bro, I've got a lot of research to do. I honestly think the last 40 minutes just went over my head.
I honestly, like, all I learned was that I have to do math again, and I thought I was done since college.
I'm Asian.
No, all I do is not math. Even close.
That makes me sad. I'm just going to let Daryl dial it for me.
But either way, but thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Daryl.
Thank you for having
Levi for coming
thank
tonight.
You for having
really
me,
appreciate it.
Yeah, and a lot of fantastic information from the both of you.
I agree. Looking forward to having more of you guys in the future. So thanks for giving us a listen.
Levi, it was glad to be here with you.
Yeah, you too.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next time on the Acceptable Accuracy Podcast. And thanks for listening in. We know that you learned something today. And again, if you're looking to get more into long-range shooting, there are a ton of resources out there. Beyond us, we're just scratching the surface. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.